welcome to Adult Materials. I'm Faye. Hi.
And I'm Rachel. Hello.
This is a podcast where we're reading through and discussing Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials novels, a chapter at a time, spoiler free.
In this episode, we are talking about chapter 26 of The Amber Spyglass, The Abyss.
We're back.
Second episode back after our big break. And Feeling good.
How does it feel to be 30 now, Rich? That is big question.
I've joined the coolest club in the world.
Yeah, you have. Everybody say happy birthday to Rich. Messages and say it. I did put it out on Instagram and stuff, but we give Rich all the love. She deserves it.
Oh, thanks. It's my last year of being able to use my 26 to 30 rail card.
Oh, yeah.
RIP my bank account.
You better be going on so many trains this year, girl.
I'm gonna get trains just for the sake of it.
Yeah. Yeah. How was your 30th? Did you have a nice one?
I did. I had a lovely time. I invited a bunch of people to come back to the village I grew up in to camp and have a lovely time camping in a field. And then the day after my birthday, I went to the village, big old weird pagan festival, which has big Midsummer energy. And it was lovely. It was a lovely, lovely weekend.
Good. Yes. I like how I'm talking about it like I wasn't there.
Yes. Faye was there, but she did bail before the weird pagan festival because she was a little bit too hungover and had not slept because camping is hard.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm so good. I'm definitely going to be there for Garland next year. But I just woke up that morning and I was like, I can't. Do you know when you're like all like a little bit hungover, really sleep deprived, and also like socialed out? I was like, I knew if I'd have stayed for that day, I wouldn't have been rude to anyone, but I just would have been not the nicest version of myself in terms of in a group of people. I would have been quite reserved, and I was like, nobody needs that.
Very fair.
But no, the rest of it was great. We camped two nights and did lots of fun camping stuff, and yeah, it was great. Had a lovely barbecue.
To be fair, the bit between when people were leaving after camping and Garland starting, I was like, oh, I need a nap.
Yeah.
All I want is a nap. This is being 30. All my life requires is a nap to make everything better.
For sure. Oh, it's like the second night when I went into the tent for a bit for a nap and I was like, I can't. I need to nap. And then after that, I was fine. I was like, he's just in 30s. It's nap time, you know?
It sure is. But yes, I've had a lovely time. I've joined the 30 club. This is it.
Yeah.
Great.
She's here finally. I guess we have some exciting news about merch.
Merch, 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 merch. Merch, merch, merch. I haven't done that in a very long time.
No, you haven't. So we have one new t-shirt in two different colours. We have that coming out. We have some mugs. The t-shirts are hung behind Rich in her room, which you won't be able to see, but so we'll just keep teasing them. When this episode comes out, they won't be out yet, but we are teasing you to let you know what we're going to give you. And we are going for t-shirts, mugs and list pads, which will be
yes.
fun, and potentially some fun, like really nice, like handmade merch from Rach.
Yes, I'm waiting for some stuff to arrive, and then I will be doing like a really fun little day where I do some like small batches of handmade items, which will be like limited because I will only have certain times where I have the time to make them. So yes, I'm very excited for this.
Me too. They're going to be great. I'm excited for all the new merch. So you need to basically follow us on social media at HTMPod because we are likely to launch the new merch in between this episode and the next episode. So if you want to get on it straight away, then make sure to follow us on social media. Otherwise, we'll tell you all about it in the next episode. But yeah, we're excited. We've been wanting to do like new merch stuff for ages and life kind of got in the way. So we're happy to like get it kickstarted now.
And by life, you mean I turned 30 and it was lovely.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I guess even before that, because we've been these designs that we're using, we've had them for a long time.
I made
time.
Them ages ago.
Yeah.
Very true.
So life definitely did get in the way, but hopefully everyone likes them. Patrons seem to like the design, so hopefully that's
yeah, a good sign.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, merch, we're very excited about it, and hope everyone likes it, because we know it's much easier to do t-shirts than it is to do any other kind of merch, so we're like excited to have something other than like merch and stickers and bookmarks in the shop.
Yeah, the t-shirt ordering system that we do that makes it easier to have a good range of sizes also means that it's less risky for us to release a t-shirt design, because we're having to order things in bulk, whereas everything else we have to like get it in and be like, please like it.
Yes, please buy it, so that it's not cramping up space. And
I don't have space.
Yeah, right. Oh my god, I was going to ask you the question, but I can't. That's not my job.
Hey, Faye.
Hi.
What would your demon have been this week?
So, there's a new show on BBC One that's really, really good. And I can't remember the name of it. My phone's in the other room. I think it's called Spy Planet, potentially. And it is like a nature... I might have just made that name up. Let me find it. It is a nature show with David Tennant's doing the narrating. And it's basically... it's really cool. They've like... Some of them are so fucking ridiculous looking. It really makes me laugh. But they've made little spy animals to like go into like animal habitats to like see if they can like capture stuff. And honestly, some of them are so funny. There's a monkey, which is just horrifying. But there's like a little octopus one, and it's so cute. And it like makes friends with like the like another octopus, and they're like helping it, like it's like helping it build a little house and stuff. It's very cool. Like it's all about it's trying to figure out how intelligent animals are, basically. And obviously octopus are really intelligent anyway, but yeah, they like make friends and it's really cute.
Oh my God.
My demon this week, I don't know if it's allowed, but I want it to be the little spy octopus.
You would like a robot octopus for your demon?
Yeah.
I feel like that's taking the Philip Pullman aesthetic and just taking it way further down like the cyberpunk or like steampunk route, but I'm here for it, you know? I'll allow it.
Yeah, would absolutely recommend the TV show as well. It's really good. First one came out yesterday. It's called Spy in the Wild. Is what it's called. I want to see if I can find a picture of this little octopus. It's so cute. And the way that it walks across the floor is hilarious.
However, I think if you were to have an octopus as your demon, I guess a robot octopus doesn't need a tank, very important, but you would have to deal with people like the icebreaker that they would have with you in conversation being like octopus, octopi, octopodes. Yes. Oh, it's a good thing you've only got one demon and not multiple, blah, 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 blah. And then you would just get sick of it and spend your life punching people in the face or launching your tiny octopus at them.
Bah. I just sent you the picture. I don't know if it's delivered.
Oh my God, that's a robot.
Yeah.
It's so cute. Has it got a little flag sticking out of its head?
I don't know, actually. The way that it, like, walks across a...
Oh, that might be the shark that's behind it.
Oh, yeah, it's a shark. But the way that it, like, walks across the floor is funny. Because, like, the sharks are trying to get the other octopus, but obviously they can't smell the robot one because it doesn't smell like an actual octopus. So it's just, like, there in the middle of this, like, shark attack. Like, it's so cute. Yeah, it's so funny.
Oh, that's really sweet.
What about you? What would your demon be this week?
My demon would be, and Faye knows this because I was just telling her about, because I had to find a picture. My demon would be a fancy chicken. The reason being that I've just had a fancy little birthday weekend. I've just been to one of my friend's weddings, and dressing up makes me feel like a fancy chicken. And very specifically, I'm going to send Faye a picture of a silky chicken, but a black one, because fancy but make it goth. But they're just so fluffy and fancy, and their little heads are so fluffy.
Oh my God.
And they've got like
extra
fluff on their legs. So they look like they're wearing fancy trousers. And they're just, I just want to be a cute little fancy chicken, like enjoying life and boogieing and partying and being like fluffy but gothy.
It's given like widowed woman that just took all of her husband's money, and I'm here for
it. It's giving my third husband died so tragically at the very rich, I mean ripe age of yes.
It's great. I love it. Yes.
Yeah, fancy chickens all around. Let's do a podcast.
Yes, let's do it. Last chapter, Father MacPhail and his lads took a ridiculously long time to park a blimp.
Mrs. Coulter and Lord Roke, RIP, escaped the clutches of the Magisterium, and LMP tried to defuse the Lyra bomb.
Asriel showed up at the last minute to take all the credit and save Coulter.
Boo.
In this chapter, No Name the Harpy leads Lyra and Will to the highest point in the Land of the Dead to cut a window.
Lee and Joppery save Lyra's life by telling Will to give her a haircut.
The bomb explodes in another world and creates an abyss. Can we just talk about fucking Lee and Joppery making their way into that summary?
Dads.
I thought the dads were dead.
They are dead, but they're here anyway. Yeah.
And that's that's some great dad energy right there.
Truly, truly is. Lyra's got the best dads, even the dead dads.
Yeah. Yeah. So, would you like to guess what the picture is?
Is it an abyss?
Yeah, it's just a black square.
Oh, is it just... I like that. I thought it might be like...
The edge, yeah.
Like a drawing of the chasm. And then I was like, oh, it's a bit dangerous trying to draw a chasm and not have it look too rude. You know?
Like a vagina.
It's like every time I've tried to draw one of the windows for a bit of podcast, I'm like, oh, that... Someone could decide that that looks a bit vaginary.
Yeah.
But no. Wow. Good. Just doing a black square. Very, very clever. Well done, Phil.
See, you could do that for
copy you for the podcast. Laziest art yet.
An easy week for you.
Very. Yes. Do you want to... Well, shall I read you the quote and then you can guess what you think it's about?
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. The sun has left his blackness and found a fresher morning, and the fair moon rejoices in the clear, cloudless night.
I don't know. I struggled a bit with this one. Maybe it's because I've read it twice, and maybe I just wasn't in the right, in my like literature, like analytic brain when I was reading it. But there's something in it that I'm like, yes, I can sense the meaning of it. And when you tell me, I'll probably be like, oh, cool. But I can't get there, if that makes sense. I found it quite a difficult one.
Very fair. It is from William Blake, who is Phil's quote.
Back again.
Used three or four other Blake quotes throughout the first half of this book that we've already come across. I'm sure in a previous episode, I've done like a little rundown on like a Blake biography, which is why I've not done it this time, because I couldn't remember if I had, but I was like, I'm sure
I think
have.
You have, because he's come up a lot of times.
I'm sure I've mentioned that he is a bit of a spook, not as much of a spooky bitch as Byron, but a little bit of a spooky bitch. Yeah. And we like that. So yes, William Blake, born in 1757, died in 1827. And this poem is, well, this poem isn't really a poem. It's from a short kind of book. It's like 13 pages that he did called America, A Prophecy. America, A Prophecy is one of three kind of continental prophecy things that he did. He also did a book called Europe, A Prophecy, and The Songs of Loss, which is LOS, which covers Africa and Asia, because we'll just lump those two continents together.
I mean, sure.
It's a very white man's perspective. Yeah. Let's just, Africa and Asia, that's one thing. Europe's its own thing, and America, sure. Whatever.
Surely Europe and America are more of a thing that you would lump together. Whatever.
Yeah. but he wrote these three... I want to say poems. I guess they're kind of poems. They're like long poemy books, like epic poem kind of vibes. He himself has said, he hasn't claimed himself to be a prophet, but he's said some prophety things, and he thinks that all people should be. It's all kind of linked into his spirituality. But more specifically, America, A Prophecy is, I think it's like either 13 or 18 pages long. We know from our last little rundown of William Blake that he is not only a writer and author, but he is a printmaker and an illustrator. And the illustrations are really key in this text to understanding it and reading it. So I will send you a picture of the page that this is from, because it's nice. It's nice to see how he integrates the illustrations and the text together, and they all tell the story together. In America, A Prophecy, Blake uses his art and poetry to explore the American Revolution and themes of revolution and revolt overall. And so there are historical characters in it, such as Washington and Paine, but Blake uses his own like invented mythological figures to illustrate a lot of the piece, including things called Albion's Angel and London's Guardian, which are forces of the British government, Urizen, the god of restrictive reason and the origin of political repression. And then this fiery character called Orc, which is the spirit of revolt and revolution. And so the American Revolution is viewed as a harbinger of universal revolution, not just like politically, but spiritually and ideologically, which I think is why we can see that Phil is a fan of this one, because we get a little hint of Asriel at the end of this chapter when we find out that the ghost dads want to join the Asriel fight. And that is very much Asriel is having a ideological revolution.
Yeah.
And so I think that makes a lot of sense in this. And it is a lot to do with like viewing the like construction of the British government, the British rule over America and the American Revolution as a fight not just against that colonial oversight, but also against like ideological oversight and like structured ideological control as like a concept, I guess. Very much Phil's jam, very much the jam of this book. I can read you the whole page, it's not too long if you like, and this page is from the point of view of Orc, the like revolutionary character.
Orc, great name.
Great name. I will send you a photo of the page actually, because he is naked.
Nice.
And therefore,
I love that you're like fail like this.
Fail like this. He's naked. Where's the page? Where was I looking? Okay. Oh, here we go. I quite like Blake's illustration style. It's all very, it's quite like washy and watercolory, and then the writing always looks really cool in amongst it. And because of the way that he illustrates, he does plates. So there's like 15 different versions of this that he printed, but each one is painted and colored in differently, so all the line art is the same but the coloring in is different.
That's really cool.
Yeah, if anyone wants to look for the picture to go next to the podcast as I'm describing it, I can tell you about the picture, which is of Orc is pictured at the top naked looking up at the sky, and this is a song that he's singing, and then there's some little symbolism at the bottom, which is throughout the poem the armies of Britain, the like fighting power that is Britain, is this is depicted as like a scaly dragon, and there's a little lizard at the bottom of this page because it's like after the revolution and things are settling a bit, and the dragon's turned back into a little lizard.
Oh.
Which is cute.
Yeah.
And then there's like a little frog at the bottom that symbolizes like the rightful king, but he's a little frog. And then there's a thistle that has gone from being all spiky and is like wilted down into being a chill thistle because it's like post-war, and that's kind of what this song is, this poem is about. It's a song that is being read by Orc, which is the character depicted at the top. So the morning comes, the night decays, the watchmen leave their stallions, the grave is burst, the spices shed, the linen wrapped up, the bones of death, the covering clay, the sinews shrunk and dried. Reviving shake, inspiring move, breathing, awakening. Spring like redeemed captives when their bonds and bars are burst. Let the slave grinding at the mill run out into the field. Let him look up into the heavens and laugh with the bright air. Let the enchained soul shut up in the darkness and in sighing, whose face has never seen a smile in 30 weary years, rise and look out. His chains are loose, his dungeon doors are open, and let his wife and children return from the oppressor's scourge. They look behind at every step and believe it is a dream, singing, the sun has left his blackness and found a fresher morning, and the fair moon rejoices in the cloudless night, for empire is no more, and now the lion and the wolf shall cease.
Oh, yeah, I guess like hearing the rest of that part of it, it makes sense, right? Because we're setting the ghosts free in this chapter.
Yeah, so it's very much going, oh, American Revolution, setting people free from the bonds of not only slavery, which took a lot longer than that to end, but also the oppressiveness of the colonial British presence. But then also for us, it's the oppressiveness of the authority and the ghosts and letting them walk out into the night sky. And it's like,
Yeah, that's, yes. I like it. It's nice.
Yes, yes, yes. Good choosing quotes, Phil.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's almost like you're Oxford University educated or something.
Almost. Almost, yeah. Well, shall we talk about this chapter?
Let's.
So I like put a sticker on my like notes straight away because I was like, I'd love the first couple of lines. The description of the darkness is great. It was dark with an unfolding blackness that pressed on Lyra's eyes so heavily that she almost felt the weight of the thousands of tons of rock above them. I Love that description, because I think whenever you're in like such an oppressively dark place, it kind of does feel like there's something metaphorically piling on your eyes to like make it feel really heavy.
Yes. Have you ever, I've not taken you on a cave tour, have I?
Mm-mm.
Next time you visit, we're going to do a cave tour, because one of the caves in my village, at the midpoint of the tour, you're down so deep in the cavern that they say literally no natural light can reach you. And then they switch the lights off and you get to experience total and complete darkness. And it's a little bit scary.
I think I
really
did
good.
That. Do you know, like I said, I used to come to your village all the time with school. I think we did that in school, but it's years before. I'd love to do it again. It's like, obviously.
That's
years.
The bit on the school trips where they're like, if anyone's scared of the dark, we can walk into the next like cave system and like have a torch on so that you don't get frightened, which is really sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. But I'd love to do that again, definitely.
Yeah. But yeah, that's, I imagine, I feel like we should do that so we can feel what it's like to be Lyra.
Yes, absolutely. R.I.P. Tali's dragonfly.
Pour one out for the dragonfly. Mm-hmm. It's a very sad chapter with a lot of mortality of small things being brought up repeatedly.
Yeah, it is. And also the fact that Sally's dragonfly is also dying and she's feeding it her blood. And there's a nice little bit where Lyra doesn't know, but she's like, if she did, she would offer her own blood because she's got more of it. And I was like, that's very sweet.
I didn't realise that the dragonflies glowed. I think I knew they were bright and shiny, and they've been referred to as like the points of brightness in the room. But I always assumed it was just like from vivid colour.
Interesting.
And not like an actual glow, like a.
I feel like I did assume that they glowed, but maybe I'm thinking more of what are the bugs that light up? The butts that light up.
Yeah, glowworms.
Is that what you said?
Fireflies.
Fireflies. Yeah. Maybe I was thinking more along those vibes, but yeah, apparently they did glow.
Not so much anymore. Oh no.
Oh boy. So No Name is guiding them up to find somewhere to cut a window, and the ghosts are all following. Lyra has a thing at the minute of saying that she's like not brave and stuff, and I'm like, girl, you are. You're so brave.
Truly, why is she negging on herself? Why does she keep saying that? Like, and also the fact that the harpy's not punched her in the face means that she genuinely thinks it and that it's not a lie. Which is mean.
Right.
Stop. Like, you are brave, Lyra. You've done like a whole two books worth of adventure.
Yeah.
Two and a half.
Exactly. Exactly. And, right, at this point, in my opinion, the most important part of this chapter, even though a lot happens. But as she stumbled forward, a voice spoke just beside her, a familiar voice. Lyra, Lyra child. And she turned into light. Mr. Scoresby, oh, I'm so glad to hear you. And it is you, I can see. Just, oh, I wish I could touch you. In the faint, faint light, she made out the lean form and the sardonic smile of the Texan aeronaut, and her hand reached forward of its own accord in vain.
And then Lee Scoresby gets his very own Whoopi Goldberg in Ghost line, where he's like, Lyra, you're in danger, girl. But not that.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's so nice to see Lee again. I know that we're not at the end of their journey, because at the end of the chapter, we learn that, you know, they're going to come back to see them and they're going to fight in the Azrael fight. But I want more of a, like, emotional reconnection with them. I feel like we definitely got that in the TV show, because I guess they changed it in the show, didn't they, so that they could hug. But it's very much like, and I get it, because she is in danger, girl, that he's like, yeah, it's so lovely to see you too, but also I got to tell you that you're in danger and we've got to do these things immediately.
By the way, you desperately need a haircut.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And fucking Daddy Jop's there as well. Joppery
shows up. I think it is Joppery that tells him to have the haircut, right?
Yes.
And I love that it's this really frantic moment, but also it's Will just being like, stay still, I'm trying to cut your hair with the sharpest knife in all of the universe.
For like, sure. So yeah, they have a thing where it's like, and I think that obviously they didn't do this in the TV show, so like it wasn't really explained massively why the Abyss happened in the way that it did, and it caused like a bit of confusion. This is a really, obviously it's the source text, but this is a really good way to do it. It's basically, we need to cut some of your hair, Lyra, and we need to open a window and shove it into a different world so that the bomb goes for that instead rather than you, and then it's going to explode in a different world.
I initially, when reading it, forgot that they were underground. Because I was like, well, yeah, because fuck everyone in that world, apparently. Like, what?
I had a note
of
that as well.
Inconsiderate.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was like, and Will puts it underground. And I'm like, oh, okay. But also, if it causes a massive chasm in the world that they're in, there's like literally a world away. That world probably has an even, well, potentially everywhere has a chasm. But like,
literally, I thought the same. I was like,
did he just
fuck those guys?
Yeah, could have caused like an earthquake and a tsunami in the world that they just popped their hair into without even a thought, because Joffrey's like, any world, doesn't matter. What? Pick an empty one. Pick an empty one.
I agree. And my other note was, whoever cut Lyra's hair the first time, obviously, I guess Coulter, right? Why did she take it from her temple? Take it from the back, Coulter. Then you can't see it. Why is it just like sticking out the top? Come on. It's haircutting 101 if you're going to
clearly
cut some of your own hair.
Never
off.
Done a strand do it from test. The back. Come on, sort it out. I mean, it would have been harder to find, so it's probably a good thing that she had just like a stumpy bit of hair sticking out of her temple. But even so, sort it out, Coulter.
And also, Will shushes Lyra, which I always hate, but it does also make me laugh a little bit. How dare you?
I love when a shush is a hush.
Yes.
Hush.
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 Hush. It's even more passive aggressive, I feel, a hush.
Can't believe he hushed her. Honestly. Hushgate. Shushgate.
So they put their hair in another world. Goodbye to that world, I guess. Or they're going to have some problems, or they're going to have some serious earthquakes or whatever. Then we get an abyss in this world. And then the ground began to shake from somewhere very deep. There came a growling, grinding noise as if the whole centre of the earth were turning on itself like a vast mill wheel, and little fragments of stone began to fall from the roof of the tunnel. And the ground lurched suddenly to one side. Will seized Lyra's arm and they clung together as the rock under their feet began to shift and slide, and loose pieces of stones came tumbling past and bruising their legs and feet. There's a lot of shit happening here, and I do not appreciate pretty much a landslide. It's not for me. I don't want it.
Mm-hmm. Not enjoying it. Also, RIP to Dragonfly number 2. Yeah. He's gone.
Yeah.
Dunzo.
Yeah.
Just very sad all round. But Tally and Sally made it through. They clung on to Will and Lyra. Will and Lyra clung on to each other, and they are alive. But they are basically rock climbing now, because the way that Phil describes it is incredibly precarious. It's not a tiny little path. It's basically climbing along the side of a mountain face.
My upper body strength could never. I'd be straight in that abyss.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
Straight down.
Absolutely
there.
Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. I like that Joffrey saves Roger from falling in the abyss. That's a nice little,
yeah,
little moment. It's also a classic Roger. Poor Roger.
Classic Roger. Immediately almost falling in.
Yeah.
Yes. Also, I love that Lee's like, oh, I'm here. I guess the bomb went off, and I guess it missed. And Lyra's like, bomb?
Yeah, like, what the
there
fuck?
There was a bomb? Because she didn't know why she needed an emergency haircut. That was kept a bit hush.
And also, like, no one explains it to her afterwards either. They're just like, yeah, it was a bomb.
Yeah, just a bomb.
Yeah, just a random bomb.
Hush. Hush, child.
Hush. You don't need to know this. We get another description of the abyss, which I will also read.
So many of my notes are just read this description,
yeah,
of the abyss.
Same.
Because there's so many nice descriptions of the abyss.
So the dust was clearing, and from somewhere there was light, a strange, faint golden glimmer, like a luminous, misty rain falling all around them. It was enough to strike their hearts ablaze with fear, for it lit up what lay to their left, the place into which it was all falling or flowing, like a river over the edge of a waterfall. It was a vast, black emptiness, like a shaft into the deepest darkness. The golden light flowed into it and died. They could see the other side, but it was much further away than Will could have thrown a stone. To their right, a slope of rough stones, loose and precariously balanced, rose high into the dusty gloom.
Intense. We get a lot of little descriptions and nods to the fact that it creates this like really intense, wobbly vertigo feeling when you look into it, which is like fair enough because it's an abyss, but also that there's something a little bit mystical about that as well, a little bit magical about it. The harpies bloody love it. They're just flying around above it.
Ghosts are scared of it.
Yes.
Lyra has to, like, I guess to Roger, like, reassure him, and then she's like, go and tell the other ghosts that, like, we might not be able to look back that often because we've got to, like, watch where we're putting our feet now, but we're still going for it.
It's like the Lyra version of Just Keep Swimming.
Yes.
It's a little bit harsher and a little bit more like, if you fall behind, you get left behind. Keep up, bitches.
Yeah, for
we're
sure,
going.
For sure. There's another quote that I really like here as well. So it says, and so in a shocked silence, the column of the dead began their journey along the edge of the abyss. How long it took, neither Lyra nor Will could guess. How fearful and dangerous it was, they were never able to forget. So that's a really good quote. I also like that time seems to, like, not that it doesn't have a meaning to them, but they can't grasp the concept of it while they're down there. Like, they don't know how long they've been walking. They don't know it feels like forever, like, but they have no idea because there's no way to tell if it's just dark down there.
Yeah, it's like the difference between being on a walk where you know where you're going and a walk where you're following someone else and you are like, literally like, are we there yet? Where am I? And it feels so much longer on the way there than on the way back when you know exactly how long it's going to be.
For sure, for sure.
There's another quote here that I love that is very intense. So like a lot of the ghosts are like fine, chill, following along. There's some lovely descriptions of the ghosts clinging onto each other, scaredly traversing the rock face. But some of the ghosts didn't trust them. They crowded close behind and both children felt cold hands on their hearts and their entrails as they heard very vicious whispers. Oof. Entrails?
Not the entrails.
Phil?
Not the entrails.
Not cracking out an entrail midway through a chapter. And so some people are a bit rubbish, but Sally steps in and shouts and it's like, stands up for Lyra. And I love that because it strengthens Lyra to carry on. Sally shouts, friends, be brave, stay together and keep going. The way is hard, but Lyra can find it. Be patient and cheerful and we'll lead you out. Don't fear. It's like, oh, Sally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice.
Such and a great
it's
cheerleader.
Really for Lyra's benefit, isn't it? To like get Lyra back up and running with stuff.
Yeah.
So the feel, we then get a description of like the feel of the abyss. Like Will says that he can feel it and that it feels wrong. It feels like it does when he opens it cuts a window, but there's something different about it, and he doesn't like it, and he says he wants to close it up, and then Lyra's like, you haven't closed every window you've made. I'm like, all right, Lyra. Yeah, it's not okay.
I love this. Like, well, I don't know what you're about. You haven't closed everything. It's like, well, I should have. But here's where we get something we maybe ought to put a pin in.
Absolutely.
Because he says, no, because I couldn't on some of them, but I know I should. Things go wrong if they're left open. And one that big, he gestured downwards, not wanting to look. It's wrong. Something bad will happen. It's like, oh, because I can remember Will being told back in book two that he needed to close windows after him. And there was probably a hint that like it was just generally not chill to leave them open. But the fact that Will can feel that it's bad to leave them open feels like something we should maybe pop a pin in.
For sure. There's a few little bits in this chapter where you're like,
pins okay. out.
Yeah, get your pins out. Get your bloody pins out. So Tali, Joppery and Lee have a conversation now about how Joppery thinks that they should stay and fight with the Azrael army.
My least favourite thing about Joppery is that he's an Azrael stan and he still is even after he died. Yeah. Like, fuck yeah. That.
And that, yeah. Like, Lee, do you know what? I can't remember if it's been so long ago since they were together, but did we discuss that we think that Lee might have a little bit of a crush on Joppery? Because I do get that vibe when he's like, anything for you.
It's very sweet, isn't it?
Anything for you, Shaman Daddy. I'll follow you. I'll do whatever you want. Yeah.
It's just dads and dads getting on. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah. And then we learn that, because basically the Joppery's argument, which kind of, it does make sense, because Tali's like, well, you're a ghost, so you can't fight humans. So I don't know why you'd want to go and fight, because you can't touch humans. And they're like, oh, well, there's obviously other beings out there that will probably join the fight. And then they mention specters. So they think that they might be able to fight specters, because specters feed on the demon. They don't have demons anymore. So it makes sense. And then we learn a little bit about Tali and how he's not got long left to live. And Sally's got a little bit longer, but they're both like pretty much on the last legs.
Yeah. It's just really hammering home some mortality for us, even though we've been in the world of the dead for the last few chapters. Like, oh, very sad. Just reminding us, you've not got long left with Tali and Sally. And Tali mentions that it's worth the fight for him because it means that though their lives are short, at least they won't have a short life and then be punished with endless purgatory in the land of the dead. But they'll get to go and walk into the starlight.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very nice that they're like, oh, we're proud to have done this with like the kids and stuff. It's really nice. So then we get another paragraph, which we need to pop a pin in. And that abominable fall yawned all the time. And one little slip, one footstep on a loose rock, one careless handhold would send you down forever and ever, thought Lyra. So far down, you'd die of starvation before you ever hit the bottom. And then your poor ghost would go on falling and falling into an infinite gulf with no one to help, no hands to reach down and lift you out, forever conscious and forever falling.
Oof.
Ooh, yeah. Pop a little pin in that one.
Pop a little pin in that. Also, it makes me think of, there's an episode of Gravity Falls where they accidentally fall into a bottomless pit. And so the whole episode is just the characters like literally falling / floating in space, and like I can't remember how they get out at the end, but they do. And it just makes me think of that, of just like if you were to be falling there, life is right, you would get bored and starve, and you'd probably be able to have like a little conversation if you're falling down with someone else, or like just like, I don't know, would you be able to like kick back and lean, or would you constantly have, would the feeling of falling disappear eventually and then you're just existing? Just like,
yeah.
Conceptually, it's really interesting.
It really is. And I think like the kicker with this one is that, okay, like you're falling and falling and falling and falling, but eventually you will die of starvation or whatever. But then you're ghost. There's no freedom from it because your ghost will carry on falling.
Yeah, I kind of wish it was the things that the ghosts in this world could at least be a little bit floaty, and then you could maybe swim back up to the top.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, not allowed.
Apparently not. Yeah, also it's kind of clever from Phil to just have that as a feeling from Lyra, rather than like needing to explain it in a way that somebody is telling her about it. Because we have got quite a lot of, especially from Joffrey, because we know that Joffrey is the exposition person, he always has been. We get like a bit more exposition from him. Well, we get quite a lot from him this chapter, so to have that be just like a feeling from Lyra is like a nice break from having someone like Joffrey like tell us what it is.
Yeah, and for his reason for knowing stuff to just be, well, I'm a shaman actually.
Yeah, so. I know everything, actually.
I just know stuff magically, okay? Don't question it.
Yeah.
Phil put me here to know stuff magically. Don't question it.
So Lyra slips and falls. There's so many great descriptions in this moment, but like I guess before we discuss them, what is this moment here that she has with Roger? Like, is it like a show-off moment? Like, it's very weird. I couldn't like grasp what they were trying to get at with this Roger moment.
Yeah, I think it's a callback to the old Lyra, because there is a mention of, so Will was ahead of her, just too far out of reach, or she might have taken his hand. At that moment, she was more conscious of Roger, and a little flicker of vanity blazed up for a moment in her heart. There had been an occasion once on Jordan College roof when, just to frighten him, she'd defied her vertigo and walked along the edge of a stone, of the stone gutter, which we did a lot in the video game.
We did, and it's fucking difficult.
Yes. She looked back at him to remind him of it now, and she was Roger's Lyra, full of grace and daring. She didn't need to creep along like an insect. And I think maybe it's that hark back to that like childish naivety to danger, maybe. Because she was so confident in Jordan. She was so like full of life and didn't really give a shit if she could have fallen off a roof and broken a leg.
Yeah. It also gives me slight vibes of, I think Lyra has always had like a bit of a like superiority complex with Roger. And I think that she thinks that she's better than him, and she thinks that she can get him to do whatever she wants him to do. So I think like in that like moment, maybe it gave her that confidence again to be like, oh, well, I know that I can kind of show off a little bit to Roger. I don't know whether it's kind of difficult to explain, because I don't know whether I would class it as she thinks that she's better than him. But I think that she knows that she can kind of get whatever she wants from him, and that he's like in awe of her. And they have like a dynamic to their friendship that's not completely equal.
Yeah, I also think potentially it's that, because there is so many repeated mentions of the like slightly giddy vertigo feeling it gives you. So there's maybe something a bit mystical about it that's happening as well. But I think it's that thing of like, you're with a new friend, but you're also hanging out with an old friend, and you remember something that's relevant, that's like an in-joke with your old friend.
Yeah.
And you just can't not turn around and tell it to them, even if it's like at the detriment of the conversation you're having with your new friend, because you're like, oh my God, remember that time that I nearly fell off the roof in Jordan though? And like, it's like she almost forgets where she is.
Yes.
And she just wants to say to her, like, have like a little like callback joke with her friend that she's had forever. And then that's the like thing that like topples her off the edge.
For sure. I think, yeah, there's a bunch of ways that you can interpret it. But
yeah,
I do enjoy the description of her falling, because it's fucking great. And it seemed to happen so slowly, but there was nothing she could do. Her weight shifted, the stones moved under her feet, and helplessly she began to slide. This is my favourite bit. In the first moment, it was annoying, and then it was comic. She thought, how silly. And I just think that's so relatable, because if you've ever like fallen over to a point where it's not just a fall and you hit the floor immediately, but you've had like a bit of a stumble or whatever, there is definitely a part of you that's either this is fucking hilarious or like this is really fucking embarrassing. And I really enjoy that she thinks that in that moment.
Yeah. It feels a little bit like the moment last chapter where Mrs. Coulter is like, oh, ha, they're going to kill me with my own machine. How poetic. Yeah. It's kind of that same sense of humour in some ways.
For sure. But as she utterly failed to hold on to anything, as the stones rolled and tumbled beneath her, as she slid down towards the edge, gathering speed, the horror of it slammed into her. She was going to fall. There was nothing to stop her. It was already too late.
I love how long this description of her falling is. The fact that we have like three more paragraphs of her falling, the way we have, she didn't even know that Will was yelling her name so loudly that the abyss resounded with it. Instead, her whole being was a vortex of roaring fear. And it's just like, fuck. And then like Will can't even hear that he's screaming after her. And it's just a lot. I feel like this is a moment when they nearly lose each other.
Yeah.
Feelings are going to get intense. And then I love that No Name gets to come and save her. And I love the way it's described because it's, and out of the dark swooped the creature whose claws had raked her scalp not long before. No Name the Harpy, woman-faced, bird-winged. And those same claws closed tight around the girl's wrist. And together they plunged on down. And the extra weight was almost too much for the Harpy's strong wings. But they beat and beat and beat. And her claws held firm. And slowly, heavily, slowly, heavily, the Harpy carried the child up and out of the gulf and brought her limp and fainting to Will's reaching arms. It's very like,
yeah,
nice, all right, Phil, with your words.
I know, right? I love the imagery of No Name grabbing Lyra and then them both falling for a little bit, and then her like being able to like fly up. It's really
because
nice.
It feels simultaneously like a rescue but also like a sacrifice. Like, yes. I don't think No Name would have let go if she felt that she couldn't, you know. I don't think she'd have given up.
No, I don't either. There's this bit where Lyra and Will are like hugging, and it says, he held her tight, pressing her to his chest, feeling the wild beat of her heart against his ribs. She wasn't Lyra just then, and he wasn't Will. She wasn't a girl, and he wasn't a boy. And it just made me think of Skater Boy.
But... could I make it obvious?
Yeah.
But also, they were only two human beings in that vast gulf of death. Mm. Ooh, what a descriptor. Mm-hmm. What a little
Phil's
word.
Really going for it in here, this chapter with the descriptions.
Doesn't quite fit in the lyrics of Avril's song,
no,
though.
No, like,
he was a boy, I was a girl, we were two human beings in the vast gulf of death.
There you go. That is the superior version of Skater Boy, 100%.
Yes.
So Lyra, like, kisses No Name all over. She has all the confidence and vanity shaken out of her, which, again, is a great description of that. If you've ever been, you know, like, a bit... Do you know, like, this is what I mean about her, like, showing off in front of Roger, I guess. I think, like... her then having the confidence and vanity shaken out of her, she got that from that interaction with Roger. So, and then it's because she obviously, we knew earlier in the chapter, she didn't feel brave, she didn't feel confident. And then she kind of got that from that interaction with Roger. And then I think we've all been in this position where we've been like a little bit showy off or like a little bit too confident. And then something happens, like you fall or whatever, and you get it all shaken out of you. And then you just feel a little bit sad and a little bit embarrassed.
Yeah, like when someone does the like, oh, saved your life moment, but then they actually then fall over and you're like, fuck.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. So they set off again, but they're like going really slowly now. And there's a point that Phil makes where it's like, maybe they could even die of fatigue. Like, that's how like grueling this process is. They think that they see a way out, but then No Name is like, no. It's still too low. We need to go higher. And I bet at that point they were just like, for fuck's sake, please. Mm-hmm. Please.
You're halfway up the mountain, you've seen a cool view, you're like, should we just not go all the way to the top? And then the person that's like planned the hike is like, no, the view from the top is better than this also very nice view.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fine.
So they carry on for a little while longer, and then they do find somewhere, and then this is where we get exposition job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We'll ask him like what's going to happen when they go outside. Joffrey tells him about him and Lee, they're going to fight, and then they say, you need to find your demons again, you need to go to Azrael's world because that's where they are.
And then he's like, how do you know our demons have gone to my father's world? And he's like, I was ashamed when I was alive, actually. You can ask the alethiometer to check.
Actually, okay.
Like, just I just found that really arrogant. I was like, she's like, oh, you can Google it if you don't believe me.
Yeah.
Like, okay. I mean, maybe I will, just to be sure.
Yeah. It's funny though, isn't it? Because like, Joppery does have that vibe about him. It's very apparent in the books that he does have a bit of a almost Asriel-esque vibe about him, but nowhere near on the like level of Asriel. And I think that Andrea Scott did a really good job of portraying that in the TV show as well. He definitely does have a little bit of arrogance about him.
Yeah, Andrew Scott put a little bit more like warmth to the dad vibes, I think, than what we actually get in the books, because I'm sure Will is like, there's a couple of mentions in this chapter how Will's like aware that his dad is there, but that he's concentrating on climbing and can't have a conversation with him. And there's lots of like, Will wants to have a conversation with his dad, but can't quite because they're busy discussing something else, or because he's busy being told, there's no time to talk right now, you need to cut Lyra's hair, or there's no time to do this right now, quick, cut a window into the other world, we'll talk later. And it's kind of dismissive, and like he's not having that emotional moment that we do get in the TV series where they actually have like a, oh my goodness, you've grown up to be a man and have that father-son moment. And maybe it's coming, but in this chapter we certainly don't get it. We just get, come on folks, let's do the list of things on our to-do list to help Asriel out. And it's like,
yeah, 100%. Yes. And then this is where we get the explanation or an explanation of, one, to pop a pin in, you can't live in a world that you weren't born in. And we learn that's why Joppery got really sick. We learn about it happening to other people like Boreal. So it's the demon, isn't it? Your demon can only live its full life in the world where it was born. Otherwise, it will eventually sicken and die.
Sad times. I kind of enjoy somewhat of the message that kind of goes along with it. Because there's a line that is, we can travel if there are openings into other worlds, but we can only live in our own world. That's why Lord Asriel's great enterprise will fail in the end, for the same reason. We have to build the Republic of Heaven where we are, because for us there is nowhere else. And it feels like there's a kind of extra message in there that's just like, you've got to fight the good fight where you're standing. You can't tackle all the world's problems in one fell swoop. You have to like get involved with your local community and fight the magisterium in your local area. You can't do it on a global level kind of vibe.
I think like for me, like I think that what you said absolutely makes sense, and it's a very good like reading of it. I think for me, I was a bit like, oh, that's interesting that he's saying that Asriel's Republic's gonna fail at some point,
and yet he's still so keen to fight for it.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me, because it's like we've had it set up as if like, because obviously Asriel's like the king of arrogance, that like this is the be all and end all, and this is gonna like save the world forever and ever. And it's like, oh, okay, well it will fail at some point, because Asriel can't be there forever.
I like that it kind of hammers home the whole thing of like, and that's why the kid's story is the main story, that's why Lyra's doing something more important, and why it really hammers home that Asriel's a dickhead. But why it really like is like, yeah, and even the people that are his like biggest stands really are actually like, it probably won't work, but we're doing it because we like to feel like we're fighting the good fight. And actually it's something smaller and like two kids and a knife rescuing all the ghosts that actually will probably make a bigger impact than what Asriel's doing.
True. So Joppery then tells Will and Lyra to go and have a rest, and then come back and help him and Lee, which is nice. They do deserve a rest. God fucking hell, can you imagine how knackered you'd be?
Ridiculous. I also love that it's delaying him and Will having like a proper conversation again, though, being like, no, go and have a nap. We won't have a father-son heart-to-heart until after you've had a nap.
That's true. Like, Will is just pining for this interaction at this point. So they cut into a world and it's really beautiful and it sounds lovely and I would like to go there.
Yeah, it's very sweet. I'm going to read the description. Will and Lyra exchanged a look, then he cut a window, and it was the sweetest thing they had ever seen. The night air filled their lungs fresh and clean and cool, and their eyes took in a canopy of dazzling stars and the shine of water somewhere below. And here and there were groves of great trees as high as castles dotting the wide savannah. Big old trees, eh? Yay.
Oh, interesting. I wonder where that is. Yeah, I like that he makes the window as big as he can so that all the like ghosts can fit through it. And then we say bye to Roger.
We do. It's it is a little bit sad, like poor one out for Roger, the final Roger goodbye.
Yeah. So the first ghost to leave the world of the dead was Roger. He took a step forward and turned to look back at Lyra and laughed in surprise as he found himself turning into the night, the starlight, the air, and then he was gone, leaving behind such a vivid little burst of happiness that Will was reminded of the bubbles in a glass of champagne.
Love it. Pour out a glass of champagne for Roger. Yes, he's a fancy ghost.
He's bougie. Bougie Roger. Love it. Love it. And then Will and Lyra just fall on the grass.
Conk out. Have a well-deserved nap.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that because Will and Lyra are so tired, and we're kind of tired from reading through the intensity that was that chapter, that the actual window cutting and ghosts going through bit at the end is just... Yeah, and it was really bloody nice.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's not like a massive long description or overly emotional, or it is just, and then you kind of like, and they knew that what they did was right because it was so simple and so nice and so peaceful. And it's like,
Yeah, exactly. It's a nice way to end the chapter. And yeah, I'm just happy they got out of there because it was it was a bit depressing for a bit being in there for so long.
Sure was. Do you want to know what the next chapter is called?
I would love to.
It is called The Platform.
Ooh.
And I see the word Malefa on the first page, so I suspect we're back with Mary.
Nice. Love that. Yes, I'm looking forward to being back with Mary.
I've missed her.
Me too.
I've missed her. Now, especially because we've had a break. So it's nice that we've come back and the first three chapters back, we'll be like, okay, we'll catch up with Coulter. Okay, now we'll catch up with Lyra and Will. And then we get to catch up with Mary and it'll be nice.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. So, who is your award for?
My award is for... RIP, pour one out for the dragonflies.
Oh,
Joint award for the dragonflies. And kind of therefore for Tally and Sally, because we've talked a lot about their mortality this chapter. And the dragonflies did a lot to light the way. And Tally and Sally, well, Sally specifically did a lot to like encourage people and give Lyra hope. So I think it's like a general Gallivespian gift bundle, I think is what I want to give this week. Yes.
That's a nice one.
What about you?
Mine's for No Name.
Oh, yeah.
I think she did a great job this chapter leading everyone out and also saving Lyra, you know?
Yeah, that was a really good description. And No Name got all the praise. I love how like she's gone from being hated and feared by the ghost to then getting like praised by everyone after she saved Lyra. I feel like she was probably like, me?
Yes, for sure. For sure. I love that for her. It's well deserved. It's well deserved.
Yes. And lots of sloppy kisses on her stinky face.
Yeah.
From Lyra.
Was a bit gross, I'm not going to lie, but I appreciate that from Lyra. She's a better person than I am because I don't think I would have done that.
Yes.
Well.
Well, indeed.
Well, indeed. Do you want to, when you finish your big yawn, do you want to do a review spiel?
I do. Hey folks, if you're enjoying the podcast and you want to support us, one of the best ways to do it is to leave us a review. And we're still running a little review thing. We're very close to having enough entries to start pulling names from that hat. So the deal is, leave us a review. Please make it a nice one. If you're going to leave us a bad review, don't bother entering the prize draw, because that would be really weird.
Please don't.
Yes, please leave us a review. Send us a screenshot of your review to our email address, her.materialspod@gmail.com, and we'll enter you into a prize draw to win some super cute bookmarks and stickers for merch stuff.
Yay.
And yes. It's one of the best ways to help and support the podcast because it helps us show up in all the searches and stuff. Fun fact, I'm sure we mentioned it when it happened, you can leave us reviews on Spotify. Can you do it on Facebook?
I think so, yeah.
Apple Podcasts is the main one. That's the big one. But yes, it's nice that you can give us a little 5-star and a follow on Spotify, because that's also very handy.
Yes.
Do all the things. Help boost the podcast. Help support your local podcasters.
Yes, please.
Do fight the fight in the place that is local to you, which is your ears right now with your friendly podcasters.
Absolutely. Tell a friend about us. We say this in the outro, but we have a Patreon that we've mentioned. You can support us there. You can buy merch. All these things are really helpful. And also, we bloody love an email, so you can always email us. You can always tweet us, messages on Instagram. We're always so excited when we get messages from people.
Yeah, yes.
Yay. Yes.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Her Dark Materials. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at HDMPod, and you can email us at herdarkmaterialspod@gmail.com. You can also visit our website at hdmpod.co.uk.
If you want to support us, you can become a patron at patreon.com/HDMPod. We also have a shop where you can buy merch featuring all original artwork from Rach. You can find it at hdmpod.co.uk/shop. I'm Faye, and while I'm not excited about Balloon Dad being back, you can find me talking about Paramore on my other podcast, Still Into You. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts and find us on Twitter and Instagram at Still Into You Pod.
I'm Rachel, and when I'm not here chatting to you lovely folks about teetering on the edge of a bottomless abyss, I'm making cute and magical arty things. You can find me over on Instagram at RachMakes, on Twitter and TikTok at Rach_makes, and over in my online shop, rachmakes.co.uk. Huge thanks as always to Johnny Knott for his musical stylings.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. And don't forget,
keep telling stories
and all will be well.
Bye.